Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Let's get to some breaking news. The cost of eggs. And one thing is for sure, y'all have noticed that the price of a carton is absolutely exploding.
Hi, my name's Ken from Ormond Beach, and our family household is affected by the rising price of eggs. My wife is complaining about it. I told her we're going to get a hen.
I have been affected by the high cost of eggs. I bought an 18-pack yesterday, and I only have two more payments. And it will be paid off.
We have a family of five, and the rising cost of eggs is definitely causing a major change because it was always the cheapest form of really good, healthy protein, and it's just not cheap anymore.
That's right. Y'all are not imagining it. Last year in January, the average cost of a dozen eggs was about $1.92. Today, it's up to $4.21. That's what we call eggflation. But seriously, this is no joke. So we talked to Kenny Torella, staff writer at Vox and author of the newsletter Meat Less, about just what is causing this dramatic price increase.
The first is simply inflation. Farmers have been reporting higher feed costs, higher labor costs, and fuel costs over the last year, just like every other business. But there's something really different about the egg industry in that this year they are experiencing the worst bird flu outbreak in U.S. history.
Indeed, nearly 58 million birds, mostly egg-laying hens, have died as a result of a bird flu outbreak. And in the U.S., the primary main approach to prevent the spread of the disease is simply
by killing any animal that could be infected. And so per U.S. regulations, if just one chicken or turkey is infected with the bird flu, farmers have to then kill all of the animals in that flock because it's a highly contagious and highly deadly disease.
Given that our world is now populated by people surviving a multi-year global pandemic of a deadly, highly contagious disease, perhaps it's easier than ever to have some empathy for all those slaughtered hens and to look for some new approaches for addressing this crisis.
There's a growing number of people starting to ask, well, maybe we should vaccinate a lot of these animals against the disease. But it's been controversial because a lot of food producers, egg and meat producers, fear that if they begin to mass vaccinate the animals we raise for food, then it could disrupt international meat and egg trade. But this conversation is really starting to change among a lot of epidemiologists and animal scientists and those in the food industry. They're starting to say, look, maybe this containment approach of trying to stop the disease isn't working. Maybe we need to start vaccinating against it.
Now, full disclosure, I am a backyard chicken keeper, and I'm preparing for the imminent hatch of spring chicks in the coming weeks. So I wondered if this circle of poultry life in American hatcheries might lead to some consumer relief soon.
There's no relief on the horizon.
Aww.
And unfortunately, the bird flu circulates throughout the fall and winter, and it didn't stop circulating last summer. And so we could see a situation in which the bird flu could become endemic, meaning it's with us all year round. And so it could become the new normal. We might need to get used to higher egg prices.
Getting used to higher egg prices sounds like yet another gut punch to American households.
The price is wrong.
So we wanted to understand what this egg crisis means for those on the supply side of the equation. Farmers. Beth Hoffman is a journalist, farmer, and author of Bet the Farm, The Dollars and Cents of Growing Food in America. Beth, thanks for joining The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So year after year, I think the public hears about these threats to animals, to crops. Right now, the CDC is reporting over 57 million laying hens who had to be culled as a result of the bird flu. Can you give me a sense of what this looks like on the farm side?
I think there is a propensity of talking about these things as if this year is a big problem. Right now, we're having this egg problem. You probably remember not long ago, there was a lot of discussion about wheat was a huge problem because of the Ukraine situation. Year after year, like citrus is freezing, and so there's going to be an orange juice problem. But on the farmer end of things, the economic situation of farming is a problem year after year. Year in and year out, families are struggling to keep themselves afloat because of some of the things that your other speaker talked about, high gas prices. Fertilizer prices are now super expensive. The market is really down on the farm side, even though you would not know that actually at the consumer level. I was actually just looking at the egg report from the USDA that came out yesterday. And the first line says that prices are down 57 cents for jumbo eggs in the regions of California and the West.
Help us understand how that's possible.
It's because most of the prices are agreed upon well before anybody is actually eating an egg in their home. The price is contracted for most commodities now because there's so few companies that control most of the food system. So I'm not an egg producer, but we raise cattle. And in the cattle industry, you know, there's only four companies that control the vast majority of the entirety of beef. So when you are purchasing beef in the supermarket, it looks like you have a lot of choice. There's whole rows of food, right? When you go to the supermarket, it looks like there's tons of choice and lots of brands, but actually it's controlled by four companies and they set the prices. So when we have beef ready for market, there's not a lot of different options that we can go to buyers and say, what are the prices you're offering? It's just there's one place.
On exactly that point, help me understand then, for example, why have eggs gotten so much more expensive, but not chicken, given that if this is in part driven by an avian flu, you would think that it would affect not only laying hens, but meat chickens as well. Is that because of the agricultural commodity market that sets these prices so far in advance?
A lot of it is that, and a lot of it is demand. Like I actually, in researching about eggs, you know, there's a lot of question if this is really being driven by an avian flu. A lot of it is being discussed as there's higher consumer demand globally because there's more middle class people with disposable income, which drives a real purchasing for higher quality proteins, eggs being one of them, and meats. So the prices are actually reflective of a higher demand as well as perhaps a slightly smaller supply. But again, in that egg report, it's showing maybe 5% less. So during the pandemic, we saw higher and higher retail prices for things like meat. And yet the farmers were not receiving that money. And companies like Tyson and JBS were making record profits, higher profits than they ever made. And yet farmers were making less. Part of the problem is this control and the fact that there's very little there's very few buyers for what farmers have to sell.
So then let me ask this, if demand is part of what's driving this, is there any possibility that higher egg prices, despite the fact that they are painful in the moment for households in the moment, is there any good that could come from this?
Well, I think that, you know, as Americans, we've gotten very used to having what we want when we want it, in as much quantity as we want. And the reality is that that's just not that sustainable in the long run in any fashion. So the downside of really cheap eggs and really cheap meat is that it might be helpful for individual families to be able to feed their families these products. But we have a lot of environmental implications from raising animals in that way. I mean, I was looking up this morning, and there's, you know, like 9 billion eggs eaten a month in this country. That means that there's a lot of chickens living in very, very tiny cages, pumping out as many eggs as possible, usually with a lot of chemical help and vast amounts of manure that's created because of these kinds of systems. Same thing with bacon. If you want to eat as much bacon as you possibly can for as cheaply as you can, there are very serious environmental implications. And there's very serious social implications, because what happens is that our farms get larger and larger. 80% of farms in the egg industry are raising more than 30,000 hens at a time. So that means these are very large farms, and the land becomes consolidated in the hands of fewer and fewer farmers, which means that our rural communities are hit really hard by these sorts of food systems. There's nobody living in these towns because there's not much in the way of jobs and things to do. So yes, there's a lot of downsides to having a mass production of these kinds of proteins. And I'm saying this as a cattle rancher. We should be eating a lot less meat and probably eggs. So I don't think, nutritionally speaking either, that this is necessarily the worst thing for people to be thinking about. Well, what other choices do I have of high protein foods that I can feed my family?
Beth Hoffman is a journalist, farmer, and author of Bet the Farm, The Dollars and Cents of Growing Food in America. Beth, thank you for taking the time out with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the mighty egg has cracked open the food budget of families across the nation. But eggs and the chickens who lay them are also infused with political, historical, and even racial meaning. During both world wars, the federal government encouraged families to assist the domestic war effort by keeping a small flock of laying hens.
This, then, is a challenge to every loyal American citizen. What can we do to help win the war with food? The answer to that challenge comes from Washington, from the Office of Civilian Defense. Victory Gardens.
And of course, chicken keeping has a bit more fraught history for Black Americans. Accusations of petty theft, including stealing chickens or eggs, were grounds for disenfranchising Black Southerners during the Jim Crow era. And today, outside of rural areas, backyard chicken keeping ordinances are typically restricted to single-family, detached homeowners with large yards. That's a housing scenario far less available to African Americans. So how have Black folk built this rich culinary tradition, community practices, and economic possibilities connected to and centered around chickens and their eggs? I'm joined by Therese Nelson, chef and founder of the Black Culinary History Project. Therese, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so cool.
Now, as a Black Southerner who also keeps chickens in my backyard in a relatively urban area, I feel like there is a long tradition of backyard chicken keeping among Black folk. And I wonder how that tradition has maybe shaped our culinary traditions.
Yeah, I feel like we think about chickens in sort of this modern context where we are arguing about commodity, chicken farming, or have sort of distorted sort of ideas about chicken in this sort of overblown industrialized framework. But I mean, chickens are easy to raise, like you said, in someone's backyard, from the time of sharecropping to family farming. I mean, chickens are eggs, they're meat, the economic and ecological footprint of chickens are so simple that we sort of eat of like chicken being on everybody's table is absolutely right, because they are a simple and easy and delicious bird to grow around the world. And so in our community especially, I mean, you read a book like Psyche Forson Wilson's Williams is Building House Had Chicken Legs, and you see that like chickens were political empowerment. They were just this sort of source of economic freedom. And also delicious and simple and prolific.
Say more about that. I got to say, that is one of my favorite books, right? Building houses out of chicken legs is the text there. But tell us a bit about how a humble chicken and the egg that it lays, how is it part of political and economic power for Black and brown folk?
I mean, as a chef, I think being more connected to Black farmers in particular is a trend that is so, I don't know, it's so beautiful to watch become more part of our practice, especially in the modern context. But I mean, I think so much about what life must have been like after emancipation and sharecropping and the idea of your plot of land and your couple of chickens and your hands and what you could do meant immediate power, meant immediate sort of agency. Think so much about women like Georgia Gilmore, you know, thinking about the farmers as, you know, sort of our source for political organizing. And I think the chickens became this sort of source of immediate empowerment. Psyche in that book talks a lot, so much about the way that if you had chicken women, you know, sort of on the railroads, being able to essentially start cottage food businesses with very little effort and just their hands and time. I think so much about the footprint of a farmer being able to, again, before commodity farming, before the war and like sort of the overblown and sort of perversion of simple family farming, having your small footprint of land, being able to raise chickens in a way that meant, you know, economic freedom for your family. I think all of those elements make it so that surely chicken was a part of and is important to the history of Black empowerment from a historical standpoint. I mean, legitimately an unbroken chain of proof.
Of course, chickens also figure prominently in racist myths, in racist imagery, especially from the Jim Crow era, and really all the way up to our current moment. Are there ways that eggs and chickens also carry some racial baggage?
The thing I get stuck on, and I think I've been doing this work for about 15 years. I started this project mainly because I was so steeped in my own disinformation, and I felt sort of negligent in my own kind of cultural practice as it related to my professional practice. And I was like, something about the tales we tell about ourselves, especially when it relates to our cultural food ways, seems untrue. Like there's something that sort of just felt disingenuous, right? How do we talk about a cultural food way that sustained generations of people, food that I know for sure is beautiful and thoughtful and meticulous, being sort of told to me as this kind of lesser than? I don't know. There was something strange about a story about our culture that I knew intuitively wasn't true, but I didn't know enough about the honest truth. And so I started this project, one, to be a better steward of my own culture in this work that I was doing, but also to sort of figure out where those lies come from. And I think that food is an easy way to weaponize culture against folk, and we accept the premise.
When we come back, we're going to stick right on this topic a little bit more with chef and founder of the Black Culinary History Project, Therese Nelson. Stay with us.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
On this week's On the Media, what happened to the offbeat, irreverent, speaking truth to power alt weeklies that used to populate newsstands across the country?
The Voice was their guide to life from people who cared about what they were covering with such intensity that there were fistfights and brawls inside the paper. That's gone.
The end of an era on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm back with Therese Nelson, chef and founder of the Black Culinary History Project. Therese, I love this language of being a better steward of our culture. When I first started keeping chickens, I think maybe it was the first or second summer, I'd also been growing watermelon. And I found there was a moment when I'm standing outside, like in my blue jeans, and I've got my hair wrapped up in a, you know, in a scarf to keep it up above my head. And I had opened a watermelon a little too early, and so it wasn't, you know, wasn't what I wanted to eat. So I put it out, and chickens in my yard were eating watermelon while I'm standing there with my head wrapped up, and it was gorgeous. It was beautiful. It felt connected. And I thought, I must look like somebody's racist stereotype, but in this moment, I am so happy and so connected, and my family's going to eat these eggs so well. I really do wonder, you were talking about kind of the ease with which culinary practices are weaponized against us. And I thought, if I was afraid of this moment, right, of what it looked like, then none of this could be happening.
And I was a, you know, sort of young chef, sort of thinking of working for a lot of white people who didn't really see or understand our food and our culture, it felt very much othering. It felt very much like there was no room or place for this food that I knew was perfect and delicious and in balance. And I had to do better by myself in terms of my own development, but also to, you know, sort of generations of cooks who came before me. And so I think there's something particular about the stories we tell ourselves. I'm not interested in what other people think about our food. I'm interested in practitioners who are putting on their whites or opening their restaurants or farming their farms or, you know, creating their product every day. What story are you telling yourself about the culture from which you start? Culture becomes this kind of bomb that starts and sort of reframes your practice. I think makes us all better.
Is there a Black culinary tradition around the egg? Are there ways that Black folks make use of eggs that is in part a distinctive contribution?
I was really interested the framing you gave in the beginning about the price of eggs and the sort of usefulness of eggs. I mean, I think we think about chicken in terms of demonizing factory farming, but egg production is really the most ecological sort of perfect expression of what chickens do for us. About bacon traditions, actually, most often. I think there's something really, I did a small podcast called Black Desserts, and it was so interesting to talk to all of these, such disproportionately Black women, to be sure, but to think about this sort of continuum of Black bacon and the perfection of our patisserie history, with not a lot of training, not a lot of, I guess, reverence in terms of the culinary industry, but like just the perfection of, you know, I have an aunt, Florine, in Lattice, South Carolina, who can make the most perfect genoise. And this, she doesn't call it that, but it's this sort of light, fluffy, airy yellow cake. And she does it just from feel. But I mean, eggs are so critical to our baking traditions. And Black women disproportionately make magic out of simple ingredients. And eggs are also central to that. Those the smallest of ingredients. I mean, you don't get pound cake without eggs.
Yes, Aunt Florine in South Carolina. I am lighting an ancestral candle to her today. Therese Nelson is chef and founder of the Black Culinary History Project. Therese, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So far today, we've been having an excellent discussion. And it's one that y'all have a lot to contribute to as well. Some of you told us about how these high egg prices are affecting your households.
Hi, this is Karen, and I'm calling from Covina, California. Absolutely, I am a vegetarian, so I rely on eggs as a staple in my diet. This new higher price is quite substantial.
This is Kim, and I'm calling from Tampa. And eggs used to be a staple in my house because they were inexpensive and high in protein. And now I can't afford to buy them.
And while nobody likes to see these kinds of prices for eggs, we also noted that you shared some pretty clear understandings of the complicated reasons for this spike.
This is Wayne Nicholas from Las Cruces, New Mexico. And the price of eggs is just astronomical. It's trebled. Unfortunately, so many laying hens have been killed because of bird flu.
Deborah from Cascade, Colorado. In Colorado, people are blaming the high prices on the fact that we require cage-free eggs, which means an entire square foot for each chicken. And it's not really a reason for eggs to cost $8 a dozen. But fair prices for food are something that we should have been doing all along. And humane care of farm animals, including chickens, is another thing that we should have been doing all along.
I have been affected by the price of eggs. I'm a farmer and raise chickens for eggs. And the price of chicken feed has gone up so much, I understand why eggs have gone up. But it's all a chain and it's all connected. The price of eggs is going up because the price of feed is going up.
And it's not just farmers. Other industries and businesses are also navigating how to absorb this increased cost of eggs. For the owner of a bakery in Harlem, that means figuring out how to keep her rugelach affordable.
We have seen a dramatic change in the price of eggs. We've seen the prices triple, and it has caused us to look around for other entities that sell bulk eggs, which is unfortunate for our little bakery. But nonetheless, we persevere.
Hi, I'm Greg Keenan calling from Stamford, Connecticut. I'm in the restaurant business. We're used to locking up our liquor, making sure none of it disappears. Well, we've actually started to lock up our eggs.
So what it all means is folks are facing some really tough decisions about egg consumption.
Hi, I'm Scott from Grand Junction, Colorado. Egg prices have caused me to seriously reevaluate my breakfast habits and, heaven forbid, my baking habits.
Hi, my name is Terry, Massachusetts. I have been greatly affected by the price of eggs. I am a 70-year-old woman. I have severe food allergies, and I usually eat eggs every day. Before the prices went up, I would have 2 eggs a day, and that would give me enough protein. But now, due to the price of eggs, I have now cut back to only having 1 egg a day.
And while some are cutting back on eggs, others are going for a more creative plan.
Hi, this is Kazoo from Oakland. The cost of eggs going up, I've noticed it over the last few years, and we actually decided just this past week that we were going to enclose our front yard and turn it into a chicken coop.
As always, thank you for your calls, and keep them coming at 877-869-8253.